Low college prep test scores? Trouble getting into the university of your choice? Federal prosecutors say a Florida man helped rich and famous parents get their kids into colleges with bribes and fake test scores. And the smell of medical marijuana. Lawmakers push forward making smokable medical marijuana legal. This is the Florida Roundup from WLRN Public Media in Miami and WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville. I'm Tom Hudson. My co-host Melissa Ross is off this week. The national college admission scandal involved rich and famous parents, according to federal prosecutors. It also allegedly involved a Florida prep school administrator accused of taking tests for kids. What does the alleged scheme tell us about the intense competition around college admissions? Today is the deadline set by the governor for the legislature to pass a law allowing patients to smoke medical marijuana. Lawmakers met the deadline. It's all ahead. You can join the conversation on the Florida Roundup. It's up after the news. Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson. My co-host Melissa Ross is off this week.
I'm never surprised that people will do things to get into tough universities.
That's Mark LaViolette. He is the admissions director at Florida Gulf Coast University. This week, dozens of people were charged in a wide-ranging college admissions cheating and bribery scandal.
I was a little surprised at the scope of this and the avenue of using faking athletic students. I was surprised at that, but not that something like this was going on.
Among those facing federal charges is an administrator at IMG Academy. That's a prep school in Bradenton. Mark Riddle has been suspended from that school indefinitely as he faces conspiracy and wire fraud charges. He allegedly took college admissions tests for students or helped the students cheat on those tests. Now, famous parents were charged in this scheme, like Felicity Huffman, who starred in Desperate Housewives, or Lori Loughlin from Full House. They got a lot of media attention this week, but 48 other people also face charges in this federal investigation. And the accusations really shine a light, don't they, on the college admissions process, an opaque and stressful process for lots and lots of students and parents. So do wealth, privilege, and access trump talent, merit, and potential? In Florida, with a dozen state universities receiving billions of dollars in state support, what's the access Florida parents and students have to higher education? What's your experience with the college admissions programs? 305-995-1800, our statewide phone number wide open today, 305-995-1800, to share your stories and experiences with the college admissions process. Did you get into the school that you wanted to get into? What's your connection to the admissions process, perhaps with a niece or a nephew, your child? At Florida Roundup is our Twitter handle. John Delaney is along with us, the former mayor of Jacksonville and president emeritus at the University of North Florida. Colleen Wright writes about education for the Miami Herald. Colleen, let's start with you. How do prosecutors say this scheme worked exactly?
So this scheme is, you know, this alleged scheme is very different in the fact that, you know, usually investigations kind of come from the bottom up, right? Kind of like the lower level staff, kind of, you know, sell out and tip off to kind of the top of the iceberg. This kind of came from a top-down approach. So the organization at the center of this investigation is called Key Worldwide Foundation. It's run by a man named William Rick Singer. And he was actually taken on as a cooperating witness last year in 2018. But basically, the complaint alleges that some of this activity has been going on since 2011. And there are 50 people charged, you know, in this investigation, but it came out that there are upwards of 750 families, so we may be seeing more. How it worked is when Singer became a cooperating witness, he kind of went back and called all of, you know, some of the families that were involved before to see if they wanted to get a younger sibling or tried to talk about, you know, the bribes and what they had worked on, you know, in the past to get their kids into the school of their choice. So there's the scheme is not just paying to get the side door admission for college sports. Some students posed as athletes. In other cases, a proctor would take the test for the child, mm-hmm. sometimes with or without their knowledge. Sometimes the proctor would correct their scores after. In the case involving a man from Miami with Miami ties with the Little Haiti Innovation Project, he paid this organization and this man to have someone take courses to inflate his daughter's GPA mm-hmm. so she could go to USC.
In some of these cases, the parents are accused of spending a few thousand dollars to, I think, upwards of $500,000 for some of these quote-unquote services, these alleged violations of federal law, Colleen.
Yes. I think even one family, spent, close to $1.2 million, if I have it right. It's a very long affidavit. It's about 200 pages.
Yeah.
But they paid a lot, and there were payments that were made as charitable donations because the organization kind of ran as a charity that helped underprivileged kids, yeah. you know, with higher education.
Yeah, the insult to injury, according to federal prosecutors here, is not only are they alleging these fraudulent crimes to get these students into colleges, but also they were structured in a way that the parents essentially making these bribes would then be able to write them off their taxes because they were structured as donations to a charity. John Delaney, you used to kind of run the University of North Florida. You were also an interim chancellor at the state university system here in the Sunshine State. What are your thoughts as you learned about these allegations this week?
Just stunning. I think there's been, you know, essentially these, there was two techniques. One was to jimmy the SAT scores. The other was to have a coach that would bring somebody in, as was just mentioned, through what they call the side door. Mm-hmm. I think what's the eye-opener to a lot of the public is that it's just right in your face that admission standards for athletes are significantly lower than the rest of the student body. And that allowed a coach to say, hey, for the 11th or 12th person on my team, I'll take some money to go ahead and put them on the team. They get into the a university they otherwise maybe wouldn't have been able to get into. And it's stunning to me that it ran as long as it did. It actually broke open because a hedge fund investor got caught in some stock manipulation. Mm-hmm. And so to try to lessen his sentence, he said, oh, by the way, I had an offer from, I believe it was a Yale tennis coach to get my daughter into Yale or Princeton for a certain amount of money. And that's actually where it sort of broke open. And then that led, as the journalist was just commenting, to Singer.
Yep. Singer, who was the kind of alleged lead of this college admissions scandal that broke open this week with federal accusations and federal charges filed against 50 people. Hundreds more may be implicated in the days and weeks ahead. We're talking about it here on the Florida Roundup. Your experience with the college admissions program, 305-995-1800. John Delaney is along with us. He was the president of the University of Florida. He's president emeritus now. He also was the interim chancellor of the State University System of Florida. Colleen Wright writes about education for the Miami Herald. Your phone call is coming up in just a moment. But John Delaney, you referred to this side door, and Colleen spoke about it, as this kind of lower admission standards, this open secret in college admissions, university admissions, that there are essentially two playbooks, pun intended. There's one for academic, merit-based standards, and then there's another for those with some kind of athletic prowess.
Yeah, and of course, it's open secret's a good way to describe it because it has been known. There's a major scandal still sort of ticking at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, which would be considered one of the country's elite schools, where some years ago, one of its star football players essentially left school to go to the NFL, and he was illiterate. Mm-hmm. And that the school had been, you know, just sort of been shuttling the student between classes that kept him qualified to be able to play. And, you know, there are sometimes good reasons for that. At our university, we did not lower the admission standards for athletes. That was our practice. But sometimes art students, music students, and this is a little bit of a truism, often they don't do as well on the math portions of the SAT or the ACT, but they can be phenomenally talented students. So schools do have some discretion on that. It's a question of, you know, when is it putting a feather on the scale and when is it putting a brick on the scale?
Yeah. Colleen, I want you to kind of respond to that because that was something here that I think caught a lot of parents' attention, a lot of students' attention. You think back at your own college admissions process and wonder, why I didn't get in. Why didn't I get that acceptance letter from the university that I wanted to go to? And you begin to rethink the whole process. And it really calls that process into question at all universities and colleges, those that aren't even implicated in this scandal.
Sure. And it's quite an enigma, right? Because so much goes into college admissions. There's your GPA, your, of course, your standardized test scores like the SAT and ACT exams. There's extracurricular activities. Of course, resumes are becoming increasingly important and, relevant. And it's frustrating because, you know, there's supposed to be kind of this single out process and only the best are supposed to get in. But we're seeing now that there's a back door, a side door to get in. And when I was reporting on the story, it kind of took me back to a student I wrote about in January. Her name was Camila Campbell. She's from Miami Gardens, and she improved 330 points on her SAT from the first time she took it, which she got a 900, not great, to a 1230, which is pretty decent. And her scores got flagged from College Board, and she was afraid that she wasn't going to make it into Florida State University. That's where she wanted to go. Of course, College Board said, you know, that her answers were they were similar to another student's. It's not clear if that student was, if it was a coincidence or if that student was in the same room or not. But, you know, it just kind of shows you kind of like a tale of two cities. You know what I mean?
Yep.
This kind of whole scheme for kind of the rich and famous. And then a student who possibly really did try. And she just kind of gave up and said, I'm just going to have to take it again.
A side door, a back door, an open window, breaking through a window, trying to understand this opaque process of the college admissions process, which has been blown wide open by these federal accusations about a bribery and test cheating scandal involving Florida to some degree. Certainly, there is threads of this case here in the Sunshine State. An administrator at a prep school in Bradenton is accused of taking college admissions tests for students or helping those students teach. All right, your phone calls, 305-995-1800. We'll begin in Jensen Beach, where Rich is on line 3. Rich, thanks for holding on. You're on the radio.
Hi, how are you?
Good, go ahead.
So I have a few children that are involved in college sailing. One's done, one's currently in. And the first thing is it's a horrible for the existing sailors at Stanford and stuff to have this happen, because they're all like talented, smart, you know, hardworking individuals, and this kind of stains them.
Stanford is one of the universities that has been implicated in this case. Go ahead,
right,
Rich.
By the college sailing coach, who I believe was a really good guy too, but he made some horrible decisions.
Your kids sail at Stanford?
No, they do not.
Okay.
They've sailed at other colleges. So, and one still does. So my thing is, there's no transparency in how the coach-athlete system works. When my kids were recruited and were applying at colleges, you can talk to a coach and he will say, I can help, but I can't help with academics. Other ones will say, I can help entirely, but they're never going to tell you exactly what they can help with, and they're never going to tell you exactly how many kids they get, and they're never going to tell you how, whether they need scores or don't need scores. And that system, you know, it's ripe for what happens, right? In a system where nobody knows how it works, that invites this type of behavior.
Yeah, Rich, thank you for your thoughts there and your experiences there from Jensen Beach.
Could I jump in here?
Yeah, go ahead. John Delaney, former president of University of North Florida. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, at the core, it's not as complicated as it may sound. You know, schools only have a certain number of slots. They've only got money for a certain number of positions. And so they all want to try to enhance their academic reputation by having what are known a better freshman profile. And the profile is basically the grade point average and the SAT or ACT test scores. So the higher you are, the more likely you are to get into a school. And so for most of the admissions, the yeses are there'll be a bulk that are very simple yeses, and a bulk that'll be very simple noes. The gray area is where there's the maneuvering, and factors. Schools should have some discretion on this to make sure that there's diversity on the campus, to bring in some of those degree students. You know, as I mentioned, art.
Sure. Et cetera. So, John, so
it's
discretion.
It's a question of where it swings so broadly, and where the coaches do have wide discretion. It still stuns me that athletic directors didn't catch this. Well, that patently unqualified students were making teams that, you know, didn't have any business getting in.
Pole vaulters that have never been on a pole, rowers that have never been in in a boat to do that kind of thing. John, what about the oversight? Discretion, perhaps, yes, but what about the oversight?
That's I think, the thing that shocks me, that I could see this happening occasionally, where a coach would say, okay, the last player on the team, if I get a little money, I'll get him in. It's still, you would think the student would have to be in a little bit of that gray area in terms of their scores and SATs. Mm. But the wide number that came in through that side door just stuns me. And it's stunning to me that an athletic director that they keep pretty close oversight on the students that the coaches are admitting wouldn't have caught that, you know, somebody never kicked in high school, or they're coming in on a football scholarship and their team didn't even have a football team.
Yeah.
That's the eye opener.
Lizzie61 on Twitter sends us this note. These parents simply wanted ease of having kids in prestigious schools when they were not qualified. These were not great lengths to most of those charged. Shameful crime, Lizzie61 writes us on Twitter, 305-995-1800. Kristen in Bradenton. Go ahead, Kristen. You're on the radio now.
Hi. My husband teaches at a private school in Bradenton, Florida, not IMG. And they have dedicated college counselors at that school who do a great job. They are wonderful college counselors. They do an excellent job helping the students get into colleges. So we have noticed that there is a proliferation of for-profit college counselors recently who prey on parents' anxiety around this process. And they really prey on that lack of transparency. Mm-hmm. And they tell parents, you know, those college counselors are great, but I can do more. I can help your students more. And it's really a result of all of this lack of transparency, where parents really feel anxious about how this works, how to get the best chance for their students. So even when they're not cheating, they are really being preyed upon by these for-profit counselors. When there are excellent counselors in the schools, they're paying thousands of dollars to send their students to.
Kristen, thanks for sharing that idea there from Bradenton. Colleen Wright with the Miami Herald. What about this process of college admission counselors? You know, Kristen there in Bradenton talking about the for-profit side of that, the privately hired, certainly the tutoring business is well known, and that has evolved into this college admission counselors for guidance on essays and guidance on test prep and other kind of ideas that our parents will certainly fall prey to in the thought of trying to get their kid into the best school possible.
Sure. And I mean, you know, I think it's fair to say that all parents love their kids, right? They all want the best. They all want the best.
I don't think we need to fact check
right,
that.
Right, exactly. They all want the best, you know, for their kids. And, you know, like it really struck me when I was going through this complaint that a lot of the kids didn't know. You know, they thought that they had actually improved mm-hmm. when they took the test again, even though they jumped 10, 11, 12, 13 points on the ACT, a very significant jump. And, you know, parents will pay, you know, and as we've seen, even when the prosecutor had his press conference, he made a comment like, you know, these parents didn't go the traditional route of paying, you know, millions of dollars and putting their name on a building, you know, instead mm-hmm. they kind mm-hmm. of went this backdoor route. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, there's this need, and also there's, I would say, a bit of a social status reason here that, you know, that if they can find a way for their kids to just get in without, you know, any of the hustle, really, they'll do it. You know, name a price.
John, what do you say to parents that are looking at that process and if they have the wherewithal, forking over hundreds, if not thousands of dollars in a legitimate business relationship with the college admissions counselor?
Yeah, you know, again, at the basic, the better your grades and the better your test scores, the better the reputational school you can get into. So it's always a focus on that.
But parents say it's just not enough.
Well, it depends on how high you're trying to shoot to get a kid, you know, what kind of school you're trying to get your kid into. And I always tell parents and students, there's a school for everybody. You'll find the right fit. And sometimes the reputation of a quality school gets overblown. There was a survey some years ago done on the quality of a ranking of Princeton's law school, and it came out as a top 10 or top 20 law mm-hmm. school, and Princeton doesn't even have a law school. It was the brand, and so that's, I think, what the focus is really on. Yeah. Those advisors that are paid, they can help you become a better test taker. They can advise you that, you know, this math class is going to be better for you to get into such and such a school than another one.
John, stick around with us. John Delaney is the president emeritus at the University of North Florida. He's with with us. He knows the college admissions process, certainly. Colleen Wright writes about education for the Miami Herald, talking about the college admissions bribery and test cheating scandal this week that blew wide open. 305-995-1800. One tweet saying, my son didn't go to his number one choice, went to number two and had a great experience. Parents who cheat kids, treat kids who cheat. More of your phone calls next. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. My co-host Melissa Ross is off this week. We are talking about the college admissions bribery and test cheating scandal that was blown wide open with federal charges filed against 50 people this week, including one Florida man accused of helping parents cheat on their kids' SAT and ACT test prep scores. What is your reaction to all of this? What has been your experience with the college admissions process here in the state of Florida? John Delaney is certainly familiar with it. He is the former president, now president emeritus at the University of North Florida. John also served as interim chancellor for the state university system of Florida. Colleen Wright writes about education for the Miami Herald. Your phone calls at 305-995-1800. You can also send us a tweet with your experiences at Florida Roundup. Amy in St. Petersburg is on line one. Go ahead, Amy. Thanks for holding on. Your experience here.
Thank you for taking my call. I attended an Ivy League university about 20 years ago, and the standard presumption on campus was the student population was either talented, privileged, or brilliant. And in this case, we're talking about the privileged students. I had a college roommate who worked in admissions, and it was considered standard practice for wealthy families to donate $10,000 to $30,000 to the school's endowment to get their students in, and in admissions, they were just told to look the other way. So this is a practice that has gone on for a very long time, so I think we need a more extensive investigation into this issue. But then there are other issues for the very privileged as well. There's grade inflation, and then there are also legacies.
Mm-hmm.
When I attended that school, I had nearly a 4.0, but then I also went to a state school where I only had a 3.5. And my friends at the school, when they would teach college classes, they were sometimes admonished for giving out too many low grades and not enough high grades.
Admonished by the administration?
Yes. And then, in addition to that, we have the legacy issue, where it was also considered standard practice for many of the Ivies to reserve usually about one-third of their incoming class for the sons and daughters of graduates.
Amy, you got a lot there to unpack. Let me put that to John Delaney, who is familiar certainly with the college admissions process and led the University of North Florida. John, what about the wealth and access point that Amy talks about from St. Petersburg and what she experienced? Were your admissions folks at UNF, for instance, aware of endowment donations?
No. Private schools have a lot more discretion, and private schools could decide, we want to admit people with green hair, we want to admit people from Minnesota, we want to admit legacies whose parents and grandparents and great-grandparents had attended the school. And I don't know if that'll ever really change. Public schools, of course, can't do that. They've got to be far more egalitarian. I think what this has just brought is that there is some just flagrant problems here. I mean, the Harvard graduate that would be paid $75,000 to take or correct SAT test, how in the world did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
And, if I was the one doing it, it would take a lot more than $75,000 to have me go do it. I'd be throwing up thinking I was going to get caught. So it's stunning. But to her original point, again, private schools are going to be able to do that. They can decide who the heck they want to admit. Where it's a state school, you just really typically don't see that happening. Although in saying that, in Illinois, there was a major scandal that I don't even know how this wasn't uncovered, where state senators and representatives basically had an admission or two in their pocket for any student they wanted to get into the University of Illinois.
Yeah.
And that finally blew open.
Yeah. You mentioned the incident included in this in these federal charges regarding Harvard. We've got a caller with the Harvard story. Miami-Dade County Commissioner Javier Suarez is with us. Commissioner Suarez, you're on the radio. Tell us your story.
Yes, good afternoon. When I was in law school at Harvard, there was in my class and some of the other years right around mine, you know, some very well-known people. Trisha Cox's husband, I forget his first name. I always want to say Archibald, but I know that wasn't correct. That's Trisha Nixon, was in one of the classes, I believe in mine, Gary Powers. But the story I wanted to tell you is one that I witnessed firsthand, and it's really kind of a funny one. I had a younger brother who was a high school basketball player, a very good basketball player, attending at the time a very good academically good high school in Washington, D.C., but a small prep school. You know, they didn't play at the highest level, but he did.
What was his experience?
So I go and I meet with the coach at Harvard, the undergrad basketball coach, who was Satch Sanders, by the way, the famous former Celtic. And he was there with an assistant coach, and I told him about my brother and were they interested. And the question was, the question that they said, yeah, we're very interested about your brother. I said, you know, he does go to a very good prep school in Washington, D.C. called St. Anselm's. So they said, well, listen, here at the Ivy League, we cannot initiate the contact with the athlete, the prospective student athlete. So we have to get him to write us first. And so the assistant coach pipes in and goes, you understand, this doesn't have to be a very lengthy or, you know, erudite letter, you know, like
yeah.
You take Dear Harvard.
Commissioner Suarez, what was the end result? Did your brother get in?
He decided he wanted to go to a school that was better in basketball.
Fair enough. Miami-Dade County Commissioner Javier Suarez there joining us on the Florida roundup here. College admission stories, there's lots of them. Colleen Wright writes about education for the Miami Herald. And it really has this story of this scandal, these allegations, Colleen, really has one think back and reflect upon the process, if you did go to college, kind of what that process was like, how much weight that parents put on this, and frankly, how much pressure there is on students, which continues to increase because of the focus that we have put in the United States on that four-year traditional college degree.
Sure. And it used to be that going to college was kind of incredible, right? It used to be kind of the exception rather than the norm. Now it's more the norm. And I think we are kind of seeing almost like a backlash. There's a lot of emphasis now, right, on like trade jobs. A lot of technical education is really kind of coming back into focus, you know, because it is just so competitive. And sometimes, you know, the system's kind of set up that there's so much student debt that so many students just don't even want to deal with it. And there's no guarantee of a job. Right after. And it's just kind of daunting. And, you know, I mean, I think it really says something about just like the classes structure in higher education today, right? Because it is difficult, you know, for, I mean, even SAT and ACT exams have come under fire for being kind of, I guess, exclusive or not. Trying to think of the right word here, but kind of disenfranchising, you know, people from maybe poor communities, you know, for these kind of culturally normed tests. A lot of colleges have actually stepped away from using the SAT and ACT, prominent ones too. I know off the top of my head, University of Chicago is one of them. So it really just, you know, you kind of touched on it before, it shines a light on this whole kind of enigma of a process.
Yeah, it really does. One comment on Twitter at Florida Roundup, car makers need a four-year degree, pointing to just the continued advancement of technology and the need for education in our 21st century workforce. Tom in Live Oak, Florida is on line four. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, I'd like to bring up some other subjects. Number one, legacy. He said he doesn't have legacy. Well, I disagree with that. University of Florida does, as far as I know.
Well, hold on. Let me have Mr. Delaney respond to that. He was the president of the University of North Florida. John, what about legacy at UNF?
No, we don't have it. It's a younger school and a regional school. And I think where the legacy at a school like the University of Florida, which is my alma mater, both undergrad and law school, would be if you're on the bubble. If you're right on the bubble, you're not. If you have a 800 SAT and your dad or grandfather went to Florida, you're just not getting in. So they're certainly, again, in the private area, they're allowed to weigh whatever they want in terms of admissions.
All right.
They don't have to accept the grades in the SAT for a standard.
Tom and Live Oak, go ahead.
Okay, the other thing that I'd like to have is the public university not allow any out-of-state or international students until all of the qualified in-state students have been accepted.
Let me put that to John. Yeah, sure, certainly. Billions of dollars of state taxpayer-generated revenue goes to the state university system. John, you know this. You were interim chancellor at the state university system. You've seen the funds flow back and forth. You've seen the admissions, for that matter. What about that idea of having in-state students, Florida high school students, fill in all the spots that they want before the public universities go out of state or go overseas?
Yeah, I can't really disagree with him on that. The reason schools, University of Florida, for example, has a significant portion of its overall student body coming from out of state, they pay more tuition. And for some, it's viewed as a revenue item. You actually make a profit on an out-of-state or an out-of-country student. Florida's tuition's among the lowest in the country, and Florida's support for the universities as a state would be in the bottom 10 or 15% in the country. So the idea to find revenue, a school like Florida with an international reputation, will open up the door to people that will write a bigger check in terms of tuition.
A comment on Twitter from @SteveBeach435. Why is giving the college $2.5 million for a new wing or library a legal bribe to get your unqualified kids into a school? Those kids take spots away from qualified students as well. Colleen, this scandal is really going to shine a light on those kinds of donations that have in some schools been pretty frequent.
Sure. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of universities now are kind of spooked and go back and kind of look over their policies and say, maybe, you know, we kind of need to tighten up shop, because it is discouraging, right? I mean, I would think that this news is very discouraging to high school seniors who work really hard and think, you know, I'm just not going to bother because I know someone's going to write a check and get in, you know, in front of me.
Yeah, John, if you've worked with big donors, what are those negotiations like? What are they expecting in return for a large donation that could wind up putting their name on a building?
Yeah, I didn't personally have that. Again, you would have a school like an established school like, say, the University of Florida, where maybe they would get more of that pressure. If I could twist it to a little bit of a good news aspect, not that there's much in this two-pronged scandal, but you know, you set aside maybe the top 20 schools in terms of reputation, throw out the bottom X percent that are just not good schools. Many of the for-profits are not considered very good. You can get a great education in the United States as an awful lot of schools. As one of the caller alluded to, went to their second choice and had a great time. Mm-hmm. After that first job, most people don't care where you went to school. It's really going to be about your performance. So it's what institution is going to best prepare.
But there has been research, hasn't there, John, though, that has shown that, you know, those top 20 schools, top 25 schools, that 10, 20, 30 years after graduation, those graduates tend to have out-earned their colleagues that have gone to schools that are lower down on the list.
That is true. As I said, those top 20 schools, a little different story.
Okay.
You know, I describe it as in your obituary, if you die, it would go, you know, John Smith, comma, Harvard grad. But there's not that many of those schools.
Yeah.
And frankly, some of the highest wage earners are coming from a state school like the University of Wisconsin, so which in the South is perhaps not particularly well known. Mm. The idea is find the school that's the best fit for the individual student and make the best that you can of it.
John, good advice there. John Delaney has been with us, President Emeritus at the University of North Florida, also served as interim chancellor at the State University System of Florida, and the former Jacksonville mayor. John, thanks so much for sharing your insights with us. Appreciate it.
Appreciate you having me.
Colleen Wright, writing about education, higher education, and many other things about education in the classroom, in and out of the classroom, for the Miami Herald. Colleen, thanks for your time today as well.
Always a pleasure.
To the callers and tweeters, thank you for your thoughts on this conversation. We do appreciate you joining here on the Florida Roundup, and you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Smoking marijuana for your health has been approved by Florida lawmakers. Under a deadline of today set by Governor Ron DeSantis, the legislature okayed a bill allowing patients to smoke medical marijuana. Now, a 2017 law allowed patients to take marijuana pills, oil, edibles, and vape it, but not to smoke it, even though a voter-approved amendment did not make a distinction. So are you ready to smoke your medicine if you have your medical marijuana card in the state of Florida? Are you now going for your medical marijuana card? What's your experience here? 305-995-1800 at Florida Roundup is our Twitter handle. Blaise Gainey has been following this, a multimedia reporter for our sister station in Tallahassee, WFSU. Abe Abaraya is a healthcare reporter for our sister station in Orlando, WMFE. Blaise, not a big surprise the legislature passed this bill explicitly making smoking medical marijuana legal, because after all, the governor kind of threatened the lawmakers to do it or else, right?
Yeah, he said if they're going to do it, they need to do it by this Friday, which they did it on Wednesday. He has until the 20th to sign, but he did say, you know, if you didn't get it to my desk, I was just going to have the courts decide, and the courts were going to allow smoking, and they much rather would have did it through legislation so that they can set the guidelines up.
Yeah, Abe, the state had been sued by supporters of medical marijuana because of this 2017 law that Governor Rick Scott signed that explicitly did not allow smoking. And they were appealing that decision until Governor DeSantis was sworn in. And one of the first acts he did in his first few weeks was essentially to say he was going to drop this appeal.
Yeah, he made that announcement in Orlando, basically in the Winter Park area here. And that lawsuit was brought by Kathy Jordan, who was out in the, Manatee County area. She actually talked to her for a story, you know, before the legislative session mm-hmm. began. And, you know, she talked about how, when it comes to medical marijuana, she is a patient. She's had, you know, ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease for more than 30 years. It's essentially, you know, when people get that diagnosis, the life expectancy is 3 to 5 years. She's lived with it for much longer than that. And she credits marijuana for helping her with that. And in particular, you know, smoking medical marijuana or smoking marijuana, you know, generally mm-hmm. speaking for her, causes her to cough, which helps her clear secretions, keep her from getting pneumonia, gives her dry mouth, which helps her to have less, you know, fluids that can actually end mm-hmm. up causing her pneumonia. So there's a lot of things, in her case that sort of helped spur, you know, Governor Ron DeSantis and John Morgan to have this sort of joint press conference in Orlando saying, you know, you have till March 15th to get this passed or we're going to let the courts do it.
Blaise Gainey, have we heard from the governor's office if he's going to sign this legislation as it stands?
Well, we haven't actually heard directly if he's going to sign it or not. He did come out on Twitter thanking legislators for getting the bill to his desk. Like I said, he has until the 20th to sign it. I mean, all signs point that he will sign it.
So we're talking about smoking medical marijuana in the state of Florida. This has been a point of contention from those supporters that helped get medical marijuana added to the Florida Constitution by a pretty good margin back several years ago when it was approved in 2016. And then a 2017 law allowed patients to take medical marijuana in lots of different forms, but not to smoke it. Lawmakers this week in the Florida House and Florida Senate did approve a bill which will allow medical marijuana to be smoked in the state of Florida. Your experiences with this, join us here statewide at 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800, or on Twitter at Florida Roundup. We will continue the conversation with Blaise Gainey at WFSU and Abe Abaraya at WMFE, and your phone calls next on the Florida Roundup. We're back on the Florida Roundup. Thanks again for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. My co-host Melissa Ross is off this week.
I've been in the smoke business my entire life, and I've never heard anyone say it's good for you.
That was Florida House Speaker Jose Oliva back in February, just a few weeks before the legislative session started. This week, Oliva and 100 other Florida House members voted in favor of allowing medical marijuana to be smoked in Florida. The Senate okayed the measure as well, and now it awaits Governor Ron DeSantis' signature. The governor demanded lawmakers okay smoking medical marijuana by today. And this week after it passed, Oliva called the bill the lesser of two evils.
We don't have the data. Hopefully we will in the coming years to show if there truly are benefits to consuming this medicine in this fashion. I personally don't believe that there probably probably is, and there might be some detrimental effects as a result of that, which is why I had reservations about it, and I still have them now.
Smoking medical marijuana is where we're at here this week on the Florida Roundup. Your phone call's coming up, 305-995-1800. You can also send us a tweet, at Florida Roundup is our handle. Blaise Gainey is along with us, reporter for WFSU in Tallahassee, Abab Araya, healthcare reporter for our partner in Orlando, WMFE. Blaise, what's inside this bill? Yes, it okays smokable marijuana, but it certainly provides for more than just that.
Definitely. It allows, prior, the bill only allowed University of Florida and Florida A&M University to do research on medical marijuana. This one would allow institutions to go to the Board of Governors to apply to do research. Outside of research, it also allows MMTCs and smoke shops to sell bongs and pipes.
MMTCs?
Medical marijuana treatment centers, where patients would go to get their prescription filled. So if they want to go buy full flower, they can do that now instead of getting the oils of THC.
Mm-hmm.
And the big thing about this, they'll be able to drive around and transport up to 2.5 ounces, mostly for the people with Lou Gehrig's disease, because they have to get a larger amount. Is what I read, and when I spoke with Senator Jeff Brandis, that's what he explained.
So it allows the transport of the smokable form of marijuana. You can have it in your car, for instance, which normally, if you got pulled over by a police officer or had a traffic infraction in your car for whatever reason was searched, or you know, an officer smelled marijuana smoke, you could get into pretty significant trouble.
Yeah, definitely for 2.5 ounces, you can get in a lot of trouble. But this has to be in specific packaging. And okay. if it's out of that packaging, obviously, they'll be able to look up on the list to see if you are a patient that can receive medical marijuana. And if you're not, then, of course.
Abab Araya, how important is that research function within this legislation that broadens out the ability to do medical research as it relates to marijuana at more Florida universities and health facilities?
I mean, it's absolutely critical. You've got, one of the issues with medical marijuana more broadly is because of its classification at the federal level,
mm-hmm.
there just really hasn't been, as much research into it as, a lot of the people who are advocating it would like to see. And so you don't have answers on, you don't have answers about whether medical marijuana is as effective, vaping versus, smoking a full flower. And so having, not just the ability for other universities to get involved in the research on this, but there also to be some funding attached to it, it's definitely going to spark some, we're going to see more universities who are interested in researching this and answering some of those questions and using some of the data that we're going to be generating in the state of Florida to make those, scientifically based and peer-reviewed analysis on this.
It comes at a time also there has been more federal interest in research involving hemp, which is the non-THC form of this, right?
Yes, I was saying with Commissioner Nikki Fried, Agriculture Commissioner now there, she's trying to get the state hemp program, and there's a bill that would allow the state to start doing hemp. Right now they just have a pilot program.
Yeah. Lots of experiences coming in here on the phone, on Twitter. Cecil B. sent us this tweet. Despite the benefits of a medical marijuana card would give me personally, until you no longer automatically use your concealed carry permit by having one, I will not be able to avail myself of that benefit. Cecil choosing the weapons permit over medical marijuana. Jim in Gainesville on line 3. Jim, you've been patient. Go ahead. Your experiences.
Yeah, hi. I'm one of the original card holders in the state of Florida. I've had it almost 2 years now, and my observation on this thing is I'm using a what they call shatter and a vaporizer, and I'm getting 80 to 85% THC, which is wonderful for night. But smokable flower would give me the opportunity to get something with less THC that I can use in the daytime, where I can go out shopping or go do something. The THC levels in the product right now are just too high to go out and do anything.
Right, the euphoria that the THC induces in you is too much. Is there another form of of delivery method, though, to get what other medical benefits that help you, Jim? Have you tried the pills or the oils?
I've tried everything.
Yeah.
And the only thing that helps me, I've been diagnosed with cancer and post-traumatic stress disorder. So I need the THC, but I need it in a lower level where I can just hit it a couple of times and feel normal versus
Jim,
sitting here in a daze.
Appreciate the phone call. Abe, Jim's experience brings up one of the concerns that House Speaker Jose Oliva and some of those other reluctant supporters in the Florida House spoke about, which is dosing. You can't have a regulated dose when you're smoking marijuana versus having it in pill or oil form, they've argued.
And that is true to a certain extent. There have been studies that have shown, however, that the uptake of THC and other, you know, chemicals that come through smoking marijuana are, you know, it's better and more rapidly absorbed through smoking. Whereas, you know, through ingestion, you maybe are, it's a little bit more erratic and less quick. But at the same time, this is a question that comes up every time with this is how do you, you know, qualify this? We see this a lot of times with vaping as well, because, you know, the original laws in Florida did allow for vaping. And, you know, again, to go back to Kathy Jordan, you know, in her case, vaping did not work for her. So, you know, there are these sort of, you know, subtle distinctions in how and what you're getting with each different delivery form. And I think that's what some of the, legal and some of the judges' decisions have come across is that, you know, basically taking one of them off the table is a violation of what is now a constitutional right to access to medical marijuana.
Passed by Florida voters a few years ago, you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Chantel in Tallahassee, go ahead. You're on the radio. Your thoughts.
Hey, I'm wondering about the whole issue of paraphernalia, and does this new bill get rid of the old information about, we have to say that everything's for tobacco use only? I'm using my air quotes.
Fair enough, Chantel. What about the issue of the paraphernalia, Blaze? Does the legislation address that?
Yes, it does. When I was talking about it allowing medical treatment centers to sell bongs and pipes, that essentially lets them say, hey, we know you're using this for non-tobacco use for your medical marijuana, and stores that were selling it for tobacco use can also now say you can use this also for your medical cannabis.
Okay, great. In Daytona, Mickey on line one. Go ahead, Mickey. You're on the radio.
Wow, there's so much to say about this topic. First of all, let me just say thank you, God, that we've come this far. But, you know, even if we implement the medicinal cannabis smokable flower in Florida, we still have the situation where millions of people from around our country are bringing more effective, more viable flowers to our state than our medicinal program might allow us to access as patients. So we need to go toward legalizing the flower recreationally. That's a big thing. But we also need
that may be on the ballot coming up in the next election cycle, Mickey, as you know.
I hope that we're able to spread awareness on that and get that thing to go through. Because, as I said, we're the number one tourist state in this country, and we have millions of people bringing good flower bud into our state. And it's only fair that the people that live here can access the same thing.
Well, they'd
here.
Be bringing it in illegally at this point, certainly. I mean, the only marijuana that can be legally sold, Abe and Blaze, correct me if I'm wrong, is those that's coming through the regulated system.
Definitely.
I mean, that, of course,
absolutely.
Is true. They're bringing it in legally because they have their ID cards and whatnot. But still, we have the proliferation of the black market, which if you go to any high school or college, you're going to see that those kids have access to better cannabis than any of these medical patients are going to be offered, I'm pretty sure, in our...
That's a difficult proposition, Mickey. I mean, it may be true, but one of the challenges of this situation, Abe, is just the lack of research. And House Speaker Jose Oliva made that point time and time again, that you simply don't have scientific data to really back up many of the claims scientifically. Anecdotally, yes, but scientifically, that research has just been lacking in the body.
I mean, certainly the research isn't, you know, as robust as anyone would like it to be. And, you know, and we've seen this in particular with the edibles. You know, we've had some of the major, you know, some of the major marijuana, you know, companies that have the licenses in Florida doing deals with out-of-state groups for, you know, specific branding on, you know, creating edibles. And what you'll see is, you know, they're very specific in saying that, yes, we're basically buying their brand. We're buying their you know, their recipes, their expertise. It has to be made in-house. And that is very specific because of the federal prohibition on marijuana. You cannot transfer it across state lines. And previous Department of Justice guidelines are very specific. That is one of the things that they're very cautious about. They do not want a state like Florida that legalizes a medical marijuana or recreational marijuana industry to have that bleed into states like Georgia, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi.
And elsewhere. Fellas, we got to leave it there. Abe Abaraya, healthcare reporter for our sister station in Orlando, WMFE. Blaze Ganey, multimedia reporter at WFSU, our sister station in Tallahassee. Thanks, gentlemen. Appreciate your time and your input on this.
Absolutely.
That'll do it for our program today. Our program here on the Florida Roundup, it's produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Alexander Gonzalez are the producers. Jason Zabke is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming and our Technical Director. The Director of Radio Operations is Peter Meritz. Theme music is from Aaron Libos at AaronLibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling and listening and supporting public radio.